Good morning. My name is Alberto Garcia, Colorado registration number 34618, who is representing German Bruno in the matter before the court this morning. There's a concept that says don't take something that isn't yours. That's something you don't have to go to law school for. That's a concept we've all known since growing up. But the fact is, it's always not that clear cut, because in the law, there are certain instances in which you do have the right to potentially take something that was not necessarily yours. And that's what we have in this case. What I see is there's three issues going on here, which I'd like to try to address to the court, which is one, can the civil concept of adverse possession be applied in a criminal proceeding as an affirmative defense? Two, can that affirmative defense extend to real property? Because in this case, as the briefings show, the district court placed considerable emphasis on the fact that they were trying to occupy real property, a housing structure, not necessarily just land. And then three, does that adverse possession statute, how is it applicable to the case at hand? So we'll start with, I'll start with the first one, which is, can adverse possession be used as an affirmative defense in a criminal proceeding? And through diligent research, and I think it was mentioned in both briefs, I do believe this is an issue of first impression in Colorado. We didn't find a substantial amount of case law regarding whether adverse possession itself can be used as an affirmative defense. So what we're going to rely upon is case law that talks about a defendant's right to present a complete defense. There is a wide variety of cases that talks about a defendant's constitutional right to present complete defenses as part of his due process right to a fair trial. Here, the theory of defense was premised on a fact that Mr. Bruno and his wife had a belief that, relying upon erroneous evidence, and that is obvious, but that they did have a belief that they could adversely possess this property. This was an abandoned home. They went into it. They made substantial modifications to the home, improvements to the home, on a good faith belief that this was property that they now, this was their property.
So it's a mistake of law?
It is a mistake of law. And the third argument I made in our opening brief was that there should have been a title to a jury instruction, which, one, the threshold is adverse possession is allowed as an affirmative defense, and then two, relying upon that adverse possession and a variety of circumstances of facts for the jury to look into, that it was a mistake of law relying upon the adverse possession statutes. Here, the district court cut off that ability, said, no, we're not going to even deal with adverse possession. We're not going to let you have a jury instruction, raise a defense. We're not going to let you bring an expert in. We're not going to let you have anything to do with adverse possession, because that's purely a civil remedy. And furthermore, it's a civil remedy that only applies to property, not to structures, not to homes, not to garages, not to anything like that. And it's our argument that in his right to present a complete defense, that he should have been allowed to raise that adverse possession argument in front of the jury, have the jury then look at it and make a determination, well, one, was this a mistake of fact? Did they have the culpable mental state? But by precluding any references to adverse possession, that it cut off his right to have it present a complete defense, because this was the crux of their entire defense, was this is somebody who's new to this country, hasn't been here that long, who relied upon an advisor, who thought he could adversely possess this. He was open and notorious about it. What got him into trouble here was that he went to the clerk's office and started filing deeds, started filing home improvements, started pulling inspections, because he had a good faith belief that he had the right to do what he did.
Yeah, Mr. Garcia, no one is contending that there was a completed adverse possession here, right?
Right.
So what we're talking about is some sort of attempted adverse possession.
Generally
a mistake of law really doesn't provide a defense. So could you address how some good faith belief that you can attempt to possess someone's house by moving into it for a few weeks or a month is a valid legal defense that could be submitted to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor, we would argue that. And the state put a considerable amount in their answer brief about how the adverse possession laws have changed significantly in Colorado. They've become much more stringent. Colorado now, as all the law review articles show, is one of the more stringent adverse possessions in the state. So we're not arguing that whether he had a successful adverse possession. We're arguing that, one, Did he have a reliance upon an ad on the belief that adverse possession was a means whereby he could occupy that structure, whereby he could gain possession of the property, whereby doing improvements, by filing documents, by pulling inspection notices, that he had a belief, a mistake of law, a good faith belief that what he was doing was correct? We're not saying that he did adversely possess the property. We're saying he, as an affirmative defense, believed that he could adversely possess the property, and as a result, he didn't have the mental state required for the theft and for the theft, which was depriving of the actual property owners of their right to this property.
Mr. Garcia.
Yes, sir.
Explain for me, please. How is it that he had a good faith belief? Apparently, he didn't rely upon an attorney's advice. He didn't consult with anyone at the clerk and recorder's office. He relied upon some third person. It's a bit like having my good friend tell me that drugs, Schedule II controlled substances are permitted in Colorado, and I rely upon that advice to break the law.
I think in this scenario with Mr. He relied upon a third party, on a third party advisor. It wasn't an attorney. It wasn't. He relied, this is somebody who is not from this country. He's relatively new to the country. I think it showed in some of the testimony that was presented. He relied upon an advisor, somebody who was an accountant. I believe the gentleman's profession was an accountant, but somebody who he believed had knowledge and a background regarding the law.
So that's good faith?
It's our argument that it is.
You're bootstrapping his belief in an individual who's not a lawyer with his belief that what that individual who's not a lawyer told him was accurate.
It's that reliance upon a comment over by the reliance on the advice of his advisor, coupled with his subsequent actions after that, where he went and pulled inspection permits. He had an inspector come out to his home, where he did go and pull certain permits that it was, which in essence, he thought, I don't want to get into his mind, but I'm going to assume that he thought validated this advice that he was being given, that he did have the right to go and possess that property if he did certain actions. And this is, you know, he was open and notorious about it. He had the inspector come in. I know at the beginning, when he initially talked to the police, there was not even any belief that a crime had been committed at this point. So
let me go to the trial court's hypothetical about someone going away on vacation for a few weeks or a month. And so under your view, it would be okay for someone just to move into their house, and if later they were arrested, they couldn't be prosecuted for criminal trespass because they had some sort of thought that this was an appropriate way to obtain property?
That wasn't the district court placed this pretty dramatic scenario where anybody who goes on a vacation home and leaves, that somebody could come in and say, this is my house now and I'm here. I mean, I don't think it's that extreme, where it's still a case-by-case basis in which, are you there for a day? Are you there for a week? It's a case-by-case scenario, whereas here, he was here for a significant amount of time, spending about $40,000 in repairs. This is a house that was abandoned, that had liens on it from...
Well, let me ask you about that abandonment. I know if I want to get rid of a piece of furniture, I can just put it out where the trash customarily picks things up, or I can put it on the sidewalk with a sign that says free. But how exactly do you abandon a house?
In this, using the facts of this scenario, the way, if we're going to assume, argue this house was abandoned in this scenario, this is a house that hadn't been occupied for years. This is a house that had numerous liens being placed on it by either homeowners associations, by other government entities, because it just wasn't in use. It was in disrepair. There was nobody living there. There was an argument. In fact, I don't think the people had ever lived there. So I think, again, this is a case-by-case scenario, but in this situation, this isn't a situation where somebody went up to Estes Park for a couple of days and somebody moved in. No, this was a house that had been abandoned, that had not had anybody residing in it, that had numerous government liens on it, that was in disrepair, the weeds, the lawns, all
the owner apparently had moved out, but wasn't there just a dispute about the ownership with the bank over the construction loan? I mean, someone owned the house.
Somebody did own the house, and this isn't a piece of furniture that you put out on Monday and somebody comes by and picks up. This is a home that did have an owner, which is then goes back to the adverse possession statutes, where this is a house that had an owner, but an owner who was not living there, who was not upkeeping it, who was not physically there, who was not financially there.
So if you have enough money to buy a vacation home and you only want to visit it once a year or once or 2 years, then your suggestion is that you have to hire a caretaker to keep up the weeds and whatnot, or else someone can just move in.
The scenario is, that'd probably be ideal. I think what we're arguing is that there are certain instances when the house is neglected for such a period of time that there can be an argument made that there is an adverse possession of that property, whether it's a failure financially to keep responsibility for the home, whether it's a failure to physically be there, failure for upkeep, that at some point there becomes an argument that the home is abandoned. So I would argue that in that vacation, you have a vacation home and you don't go there for years and years and years, and the weeds are piling up and you're not paying your homeowner's dues and there's liens on it, I think that that's the situation that happened here, where he argued that property was abandoned, and relying upon the advice of an advisor, then thought that he could go in there. He wasn't secret about it. He was open and notorious. He was calling. The city inspector came out to look at it.
Well, what about when the police told him he needed to leave in a week? Isn't that some indication that you're not supposed to be there?
And at that point, yes, that is an indication he was in there. But again, it was his belief that he had an ownership stake in that property at this point, based upon the adverse possession statutes. That's why, subsequent to when the police came, he immediately went, I believe it was immediately went down and filed documents trying to protect or perfect some kind of ownership rights within the property. So he believed that, in fact, he thought the police were wrong in what they were telling him, that this was a civil property law matter. As soon as the police came, he went down there, he filed these documents in what he believed, which further shows his belief that he thought that he truly did have a right and interest into this property. This wasn't some secret behind closed doors going on. He was very open. He was open and notorious about this throughout the process.
So, Mr. Garcia, what he really needed was a mistake of law instruction, not an adverse possession as an affirmative defense instruction.
And that's the third argument we made in the brief, is that they attempted to introduce a mistake of law instruction, premised, and the district court shot that down, saying, I've already ruled on this affirmative defense. What you're just trying to do is piggyback on getting around a ruling that I've already made, which was, we're not going to have this affirmative defense in my courtroom today. So we're definitely not going to have a mistake of law instruction based upon an adverse possession claim. So yes, that was one of our arguments in the brief, is that yes, what he needed here was the ability to argue a mistake of law based upon his belief, whether it's good faith or not, his belief in the adverse possession, that adverse possession was an affirmative defense here. And the district court precluded that. You know, there were arguments in motions hearing, there's arguments at the beginning of the trial, and in essence, at that point, by the time they were submitting jury instructions, the district court says, I've already dealt with this adverse possession. We're not going to talk about this anymore. You're not going to get around that by trying to get some mistake of law jury instruction. We're not going to have this in the courtroom. So we would argue that that was an erroneous ruling that prevented him from being able to make a complete defense here. So in very brief time that we have left, another, I just want to hit briefly upon, the district court placed considerable reliance upon the fact that adverse possession is not going to be, it's only for property. It's not going to be allowed for structures. And I think that's contrary to...
Could I ask you a question?
Oh, yes, sir.
Was adverse possession, that subject, raised in any way during the trial?
It was. At motions hearing, they had a very lengthy discussion about...
But I mean during the trial.
During the trial, the district court precluded any reference to adverse possession. The trial counsel tried to introduce it as an affirmative defense. They said no. They tried to bring an expert witness in to talk about adverse possession. The district court said no. And then they tried to get a jury instruction, which put mistake of fact related to adverse possession, and the district court said no. And at one point, the trial counsel tried to read the adverse possession statute to the jury, as part of an argument, and the district court said no. So there was no adverse possession at all that was allowed during the trial court proceedings, to my recollection.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I took up your time, and you started on a point. I think you should get a little time to address your point.
Oh, so I was just going to argue, there are some cases, and it was cited by both parties, that talk about adverse possession can extend to structures themselves. I believe to structures themselves, and those are cited in the brief, so I'll just go ahead and leave that there. But I thank the court very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado, bar number 40978, on behalf of the people. I'd like to start by clarifying a couple things about the record. First of all, there was no mistake of law defense instruction requested here, and had it been requested, it would have been an erroneous instruction. What instead defense counsel did below was he presented a theory of defense instruction, which basically added his argument about the adverse possession statute at the end of it, and that was cut by the district court for the reason given that we litigated the issue about whether adverse possession applied in this case. The determination had been made that it did not, and it was not presented. It would not have been a valid mistake of law defense because if you look at 18.15.042, which provides the criteria for a mistake of law defense, relying on an accountant's reading, some accountant's reading of a statute is not a defense. And it's particularly noticeable here because we did have a very publicized revision of the adverse possession statutes in 2008. And that statute required, in addition to the original common law requirements for adverse possession, required that a person claiming title have a good faith belief that they are the actual owner of the property and that belief was reasonable under the particular circumstances. Now, that statute was in place for years before this, and in fact, in the affidavit of adverse possession, which appears in Exhibit 1 that defendants signed that alerted police to this issue, he actually cites to the revised, updated 2008 statute, which requires belief that you are the actual owner. Now, in this case, there was no such belief, and he admitted it. There was undisputed evidence that he'd told the police that, yes, I made an offer to buy this property, but it's abandoned, so I just moved in. He knew that he was not the actual owner of the property, and he fully admitted it. Another correction to the record very quickly would be that there was substantial evidence about adverse possession presented at trial. In fact, defendant's only witness that he provided was an attorney he'd consulted with after he was arrested, who testified about the 2008 change of the statute and said, look, after I was able to understand what it was he was saying, I had to tell him there was no way for you, even if you'd lived here for 25 years, to complete adverse possession because you knew this wasn't your property. So the simplest way for this court to affirm in this case would be, it doesn't matter that this is a criminal case versus a civil case. There was no credible evidence that could present a mistake of law defense or an adverse possession as an affirmative defense because the undisputed evidence was that he did not meet that criteria of having good faith belief he was the actual owner. And
Mr. McReynolds, does your answer brief address the trial court's failure to either give or help craft a theory of defense instruction?
I did not specifically address it. I did note that the underlying issue here is whether or not there would be a basis to present that defense. Because legally there was no credible evidence that could support that as a defense, it could not be properly presented. It would be no different than an alternate suspect defense when there was no credible evidence that there was an alternate suspect. You don't have a right to have a jury instruction about a legal issue that does not apply to the particular case.
Mr. McReynolds, Colorado has a rich history of adverse possession cases. Even under the old version of the statute, this wouldn't have qualified for adverse possession, would it?
No, it would not. The most obvious issue with it is that adverse possession, even before the revision of the statute, required 18 years of continuous, open and notorious possession. And that alone would have been enough reason to refuse to give this instruction, even if this had been a civil case where adverse possession could theoretically apply.
But well, they, under the history of adverse possession in Colorado, it was a useful tool to help people figure out property lines for ranches and open range. It wasn't applied to dwellings. Did you ever run across a case that where it was applied to a dwelling?
I was not able to find one here. I did in my research find that there have been, following the housing crisis in 2008, there have been a number of cases like this one, and there are actually more here in Colorado besides this one, where houses that were abandoned or left aside during a foreclosure dispute with a bank were moved into. I think one of the Law Review articles recounts a number of those different kinds of cases. But as far as a successful adverse possession of a residence, I did not find one in Colorado. For the most part, it is, as Judge Hawk found below, used for boundary disputes. But I don't think that we have to rely on that distinction or that narrowing of the adverse possession statute in this case, because we have no facts that could possibly support it. Turning to sort of the broader, bigger question of whether or not adverse possession would be ever a defense in a criminal case, I think it can't, and there are two reasons for that. The first is a practical one. If you were in good faith possession for 18 years, it's difficult to imagine how there would be probable cause to bring a criminal trespass or a theft charge against you. And as far as theft, where most charges that are not continuing offenses, you'd have a statute of limitations issue that would wipe out most such criminal charges.
Well, I don't think anyone's contending that the jury be asked to decide whether he actually adversely possessed it. I mean, everyone knows he wasn't in there long enough.
Right.
I think the question was is whether he had some kind of mistake about what the law entitled him to do. And so could you discuss when a mistake of law defense can or cannot be given? What does the statute say about that? The
statute says that if you are relying upon a statute that is binding in this case, or an administrative regulation or order, or an official written interpretation of the law, and you rely upon that, and you mistakenly rely upon that, then you can have a mistake of law defense given.
So the statute doesn't allow for someone who relies on some sort of a third person's advice?
Absolutely not. Unless that third person happens to be an official who makes a written interpretation providing for that, or, for example, a court order. None of that is present here. That's like, as I said, the easy solution here is to say that there is no credible evidence that could have supported any kind of an adverse possession claim here, so it could not be presented as a mistake of law, a mistake of fact. It doesn't matter how you couch that issue, it was not properly before the court. There are no further questions? People ask that you affirm the judgments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McReynolds. Thank you again, Mr. Garcia, for your presentation today. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.